This is University Forum. I'm Jean Moore, bringing you conversations with outstanding personalities on issues of interest to local, national, and international communities. Today's program is in tribute to the Honorable K. Leroy Irvis, former Speaker of the House of Representatives of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, who died in March 2006. I interviewed Mr. Irvis several years ago when I saw him at a book signing in Sullivan Hall of Temple University while I was host and executive producer of University Forum for WESM during my years as Vice President of Institutional Advancement at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. It was a wonderful experience to see him and to talk with him again. Especially during the 1970s, he was a strong support to those of us who worked on access to higher education for disadvantaged and minority students in Pennsylvania. When I listened to this interview after so many years, I was touched with his comments on issues that today still are as important, not only in Pennsylvania, but in our country as a whole. A strong and passionate statesman, the Honorable K. Leroy Irvis. Mr. Irvis, I'm so delighted to have you with me here, and I'm just so pleased to be here at Temple.
I'm delighted to see you here. I didn't realize how many years have passed since we last had a chance to talk.
Well, the fact that you are here gives me an opportunity to share with our audience some of the great things that you did in the House of Representatives and for the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, and really for this country. Could you talk a little bit about your tenure in the House?
Well, the first thing that I want to talk about is that you find that you're teaching in Maryland.
Yes.
I started my teaching career in Baltimore, Maryland, in 1939. And, of course, I would not recognize the Maryland of 1990, 91, 92, 93, 94 as being the same Maryland where I taught 60 years ago almost. But I'm delighted to see you. Yes, I can tell you a little bit about my background. After I left teaching in Maryland after World War II, I married a girl from Springfield, Massachusetts, Catherine Ann Jones, and the job that I got was in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, with the Urban League. It didn't last very long because Catherine Ann Jones and I led the picket lines around the downtown department stores because they wouldn't hire black women, and I got fired from the job as an Urban League secretary. I worked for a while as a steel mill and then went on law school and finally ran for election to the House of Representatives in Harrisburg. I don't think you want any more details about that, but I can tell you whatever you want to
know
about it.
Well, it's almost like the rest is history because you made history, and your position as Speaker was what actually as the pioneer position in this country for people of African American descent.
That is true. We believe there was a young black man in the Reconstruction period in Louisiana, who probably was a speaker at the time. We also know that there's a man in, I think it's in New Jersey, who was speaker for his party. Mm-hmm. But I believe my election as Speaker of the House of Representatives was the first for an African American in this country.
How long did you serve in that capacity?
Well, if you ask me about Benjamin Franklin, I would smile because I served longer than anybody else in the history of the Commonwealth, except perhaps Ben Franklin.
That's a long time, Mr.
Irvis. Long time.
And we were most fortunate here in Pennsylvania to have you in that position. As I recall, you did quite a bit for education.
Well, that was my first degree, of course. I was a teacher, and I still am a teacher whenever I get a chance to talk to crowds. And one of my pet projects was establishing Act 101 for underprivileged kids who wanted to go to school, could not afford to go to school. We passed that act. We financed it a number of years ago, and we have educated 38,000 boys and girls in Pennsylvania with that act. I'm told also by my research assistants that I signed and authorized at least 1,600 bills. I don't think I remember 16 of them. I don't know, 1,600. Well, I stayed busy during the years as floor manager, speaker, worker in the political tribes of Harrisburg, teacher, lawyer, and now, thank heavens, retired temporarily from the active life, but I still teach here at Temple University.
Well, I want to go back a little bit to your tenure in the House, though, because I remember some of those bills. If I recall correctly, you had something to do with the community college system.
I was the one on the floor of the House, even though I didn't sponsor the bill, but I was the one who fought for the community college system because the people of New York State had community colleges when I left New York State in 1939. And I was shocked when I was elected in 1959 to Pennsylvania's House of Representatives to find that Pennsylvania didn't have community colleges. So I introduced the idea of community colleges, although I didn't sponsor the bill because in those days, freshmen didn't sponsor that type of bill. Mm-hmm. You got some more important representative who was chairman of a committee to sign it for you. But it was my idea.
Well, you also did quite a bit through that Act 101 program. I can tell you that as one who did some of the reviews for those programs, as I recall, the criteria allowed students to come in with kind of an alternative set of admissions, and then it was what happened in between that was important to their graduation.
We gave them money for books, for tuition, for tutelage, even for clothes. And I'm very proud of that. There are 38,000, the last time I was given the figure, young people in Pennsylvania who got their college degrees through that Act 101.
And that transcended different racial groups, as I recall.
Oh, yes. It wasn't just for black people or white people or gray, green, or striped people. It was for young people who needed help to get through college.
Talk just a little bit on some of the kinds of things that were happening that led to the Conference on Black Higher Education back, I think, in 1970.
That was a long time ago. And the person who ought to be given credit for it, although I'm giving credit for it in the manuals, was a woman named Mary Baltimore.
Yes.
Mary came in to me one time when I was the leader of the House. I wasn't the speaker. And she said, it seemed to her that we ought to be getting together all those people, white, black, green, gray, striped, who are interested in educating minority students. And I said, what do you think we ought to do? She said, well, I think you ought to use your office to call them together. I said, done, we'll do it. And that's really, I get credit for that, but it really was Mary Baltimore whose idea was to bring it together. Later on, we created the conference on, well, the first was on higher education, yes, was the higher. Then the second one was on the middle ground education, middle schools and grade schools.
Yes, the basic education, mm-hmm, conference. I remember it well, Mr. Irvis, because in that first conference, many of us came together, and then it turned out that it was not only a one-shot conference, but some of us felt so strongly as to the importance of that supporting the notion of dealing with the concerns on higher education that it became an ongoing organization, which exists still today, thanks to you.
It still works well. Not so much thanks to me, but thanks to Mary Baltimore.
I remember Mary Baltimore, and I'm sorry that we lost her.
She died
a few years after that.
Yes, she did, yeah. And never said word to me that she was desperately ill.
Wonderful, wonderful woman.
It was a shock to me when I lost her.
Yeah. Many of the things that you did in the House really set you up as a role model. And I know that's a term that's used loosely these days, but you, in fact, were and still are a strong role model for young people, and particularly for African-American young men. I don't know how much you have the opportunity now in your retirement to do much of this. As I recall, you do a lot of poetry and sculpting, though.
I do. I write poetry and have had a full volume printed, I think, about 5 years ago, maybe six now. I'm an active wood sculptor and finishing off a new exhibit, which will go on show online about mid part of December. I teach here at Temple University 3 or 4 times each semester. I have been invited back to the House of Representatives to serve on certain committees, which are pro bono. They're for the advantage of the people, and they could afford to do it because they didn't have to pay me. I told them that's the reason you invited me. I'm cheap labor.
You're good labor.
I stay busy. I don't have much time for sitting around thinking about things, and I have so many things I got to do, and I'm always running behind schedule.
What are your observations of the way politics seem to be going in recent years?
I'm disturbed by a meanness which I see growing in the body politic of this country. I'm disturbed when a governor of California can say, in effect, to the brown-skinned, dark-haired kids who come across the border from Mexico, we don't want you. Go back where you came from. You're aliens. I thought these were people who were human beings. I thought they had mothers and fathers. They had worries. I thought they were asking for help. And I thought the American people traditionally have offered a helping hand to such people. I'm very much disturbed when the California electorate has decided by a 2-to-1 vote to say to these people, we don't want you, we don't need you, we're not going to educate your children, and except for emergencies, you're not going to get any health aid from us. That's the wrong way for Americans to go. This country was built on immigration. The only people still living in this land who were not immigrants except 12,000 years ago are the Aboriginal people, the native-born Americans. All the rest of us came from Africa, from Europe, from Asia as immigrants to this land. And there's room for immigrants to this land. And I'm very, very much disturbed when political leaders like the governor of California play to the groundlings on their fears and steer the American people in a mean spirited manner, which I find to be anathema.
The state of California apparently feels that this is something that they cannot afford financially. Do you feel that's a rational response?
No, and I think they're right. It is not the obligation of the people of California to safeguard the borders of this land. The obligation is for the federal government to safeguard the borders of this land. I agree with the people of California when they say we can't bear this responsibility, but I don't agree with them when they say, get off, get out, stay out. We don't care what happens to you. The responsibility to safeguard the borders of the United States of America is a national responsibility. The federal government should bear it. So there I agree with the people of California. Where I disagree with them is that they didn't even bother to see if the federal government would do it. They voted to throw the rascals out, meaning those alien rascals who don't look quite like us. There they're wrong.
Do you suspect that there may be other than financial reasons behind this?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
What might they be?
Oh, these are not blue-eyed blonde people from the northern European coast. These are people who are dark-skinned, oily-skinned, dark-haired. These are people who don't speak English. They speak Spanish. These are the people like the Haitians who were black and spoke French, and we turned them away and let some of them drown in the sea rather than saving them, telling them, come on, we'll take care of you. This country is wealthy enough to care for, to take care of all the immigrants who are trying to come here.
And yet these are also the people who have agricultural supports for the state of California when it comes to working in the fields, are they not?
Well, they used them when they needed them, as if they would use a piece of paper and then crumple it up and throw it away when they no longer need it. And then they've got through with these people and said, we don't need you any longer. Get out of here and don't come back until we call you. That's wrong. That's mean. That's mean-spirited, and I'm a bit ashamed of the people of California for that.
You're listening to University Forum. I'm Jean Moore, bringing you an interview recorded some 10 years or more ago with the Honorable K. Leroy Urvis, former Speaker of the House of Representatives of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Mr. Urvis died in March of 2006.
Mr. Urvis, we've talked a bit about the state of politics and some of your background. I wonder if we could talk now a little bit about Maryland and some of the kinds of experiences that you've had there and what you think about that whole situation and your own background in that state.
I would not have believed when I left Maryland at the end of World War II, 1945, that I would ever live to see a Baltimore which had a black mayor, black city councilman, mixed schools. When I went to Baltimore in 1939, it was strictly a segregated city. The whites went to white schools and had white teachers. The black kids went to black schools and had black teachers. They never met. Only once a year did the teachers meet, and then the whites all sat on one side of the auditorium and the blacks all sat on the other. They didn't talk. They even had the ridiculous idea of a vice superintendent for colored children, which I thought was a terrible thing to say. In other words, colored children had to be treated in a manner differently from white children, and they were. We did not get, as teachers of colored children, as they said in those days, the books that the white kids had. The first school that I taught in was 106 on Wayshire Street, and it was a wonderful school as far as warmth and compatibility with the people who were there, the children who were there, but it was a poor school from a physical aspect. It had no playground. It had no library. It had no cafeteria. It had no area around it where the children could even go out and relax. It did have some very loving teachers, and John Cotton, who was the principal there, was a wonderful man, warm-hearted, compassionate, concerned for his children, and I owe a great deal of whatever success I had there to what he had me do and how he showed me how to do it. I haven't been back to Baltimore in over 50 years. Even when I was Speaker of the House, and my people would say, why don't we go down to Baltimore so you can see the place that you started from? I never could bring myself to do it. Baltimore was not a very friendly place for me when I left there in 1945. It is now a lot different, and I'm pleased with that.
You mentioned that you at one time had come across the bay before the road was put in place.
Oh, yes. There was no bridge there. To get from Baltimore to the eastern shore, you took a ferry. I didn't realize, being a northern-born kid, that there was a certain area in the ferry where I wasn't supposed to be. There were no signs, and I was outside watching the water when three young men, about a little older than I was only about 19 or so at the time, came over and told me in rough language that I better get my so-and-so out, where I get out of there. Well, I answered them, probably foolishly, but I wasn't going to let them shove me around. But they actually, all three of them, went after me, and I think what they were trying to do was throw me overboard. Mm. I think the only reason I wasn't thrown overboard because an older white man came up, grabbed one of them by the nape of his neck and knocked him over to the rail, grabbed the second one, and then the third ran away. Mm-hmm. And then this man explained to me why it happened. And I went on and sat down in the, shaking, of course, because I thought at the time that they were prepared to drown me, commit murder. And I think they would have done it.
Did you get over to the Eastern Shore?
Yeah. Yeah, I went over. I didn't go back, though, I'll tell you that.
You mean you didn't go back on a return trip?
No.
Do you recall much about the Eastern Shore?
No, the only thing I recall about it is the fact that it hadn't changed a great deal from the Civil War days when I was there. Blacks were still in the menial positions. The roads were not the standard roads that we saw in the Baltimore area. The school that I visited was a little bit better than the one where I taught in Baltimore, but not much better. Mm-hmm. The black people to whom I talked and with whom I stayed were very, very cautious about discussing race issues at all. Mm-hmm. When I tried to get from them the story of how they lived, they always, always changed the subject. Mm-hmm. And then I realized, remember, I was only about 19 or 20. I had all my senses at those times. I realized that I was intruding into an area which was very sensitive for them. And I stopped asking questions. I never went back to the Eastern Shore after that. I don't have any intention of going now.
Oh, yes. We'll have to have you down to visit on the Eastern Shore. You'll see a whole transformation compared to what it was.
I think you're right, and I'm joking when I say I won't go back. I certainly will go back.
Because we never know behind the transformation what may still exist anyplace where we are, right?
There's no question about it that the people themselves haven't changed a great deal, but I don't worry about that. It isn't a matter whether a man wants to call me a son of a bitch or not, as long as he doesn't want to push me in the face when he does it. Mm-hmm. If all he does is dislike me, free to dislike me, I'm free to dislike him. What I have fought for all my life is that you're not going to punish me, not expect me to punish you back. If you're going to hit me, I'm going to hit you back. If you don't like me, I'm going to make sure you know I don't like you. Mm-hmm. I don't expect white people to be my brothers. I just expect them to keep their damn hands off me and mine.
What's your thought on the current status of civil rights today and some of the things that have even happened as far as the Supreme Court of this country?
The young black people of this land have not been educated the way they should have been to what their forebears gave them. Many of them don't have any slightest information about the struggles of the 1920s, the early 30s, World War II, and some of them, through their books, now learned a little bit about 1965, 1970. We have been derelict in training our young black people what their history is. We have said to them, in effect, if you don't know this, you may have to repeat it. I would love to be able to take them on an excursion back through history and show them what their ancestors have gone through in order to produce for them the America of today, which is not perfect, and Lord knows I've never said it would be, but which is at least 90% better than it was when I was 19 and 20 years of age.
That knowledge of the legacy could make all the difference in terms of where they are and where they're going in the future.
If they know what their background is, they don't have to repeat it.
Yes.
If they don't know, they're doomed to repeat it.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you were to have a recommendation or a suggestion for the future of this country, really, Mr. Urbis, what would you see as most important in order to achieve some positive ends?
First of all, if I could do it, I would grab all the people in this country up in a great big salt shaker and shake them out all over the land. I'm joking, of course, but what I really mean is black people and white people in this country need to commingle with each other to find out that they're all human. The idea of segregation is not so bad from the point of view of economics, but it's bad from the point of view of sociology. It separates people into groups with walls around each group so that the group not walled out or walled in doesn't know what's going on. I like what I see among young people, white and black, that they're moving back and forth through the world now in ways that we never thought about. I encourage them to do that, especially my own two children, one of whom has been in Spain, France, Germany, Italy, and the other one will visit Italy this summer, because I want them to learn what the rest of the world thinks and how it looks. I am not despondent about this world or about our people. I think the young people, white, black, green, gray, and strike, are far better equipped to deal with the problems of the world than I ever was.
You have been listening to an interview with the late K. Leroy Urbis, former Speaker of the House of Representatives of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. The interview was made in Sullivan Hall at Temple University some 10 years ago for WESM of the University of Maryland, Eastern Shore, Princess Anne, Maryland, where I hosted University Forum while Vice President of Institutional Advancement. I'm Jean Moore. Please send your comments or questions on University Forum programs to me by email, jemoore@temple.edu, or call my voicemail, 215-204-4376.